John Jay College of Criminal Justice. My name's Nick Rodrigo. This is They Are Just Deportees, the official podcast of the social anatomy of a deportation regime. On today's show, I speak with the award-winning journalist Todd Miller on the US Imperial project of expanding the nation's borders away from their traditional location into countries in the global south, which have long suffered from US intervention and economic subjugation. And how the Department of Homeland Security is incorporating military-grade surveillance and deterrence equipment at the border to militarize the US frontier and terrorize migrants. On September 11, 2001, the United States experienced four coordinated attacks by the transnational terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. Over the ensuing decade, under the cover of the war on terror and the state of emergency that engendered, the US invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and expanded its drone assassination program throughout South Asia, East Africa, and the Yemeni Peninsula, committing an unknown number of rendition flights of suspected terror suspects to Guantanamo Bay and other CIA black sites, where torture was commonplace. Over the course of the first decade of the 21st century, the American empire, rattled and struggling with the internal convulsions and contradictions of capital, also reorganized its border enforcement nexus, with the 9/11 Commission fueling concerns that immigration is a national security issue. In 2002, Congress passed the Homeland Security Act, which established the Department of Homeland Security, splitting the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the agency previously tasked with border enforcement, in three. In the post-9/11 era, U.S. citizenship and immigration services, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and the dreaded Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency would be tasked with enforcing the border and managing applications for citizenship, all within the increasingly securitized framework of the post-9/11 world. Today, we are seeing the effects of this hyper-securitization of the border in the form of sophisticated military-grade weapons and surveillance equipment being deployed to deter Central American refugees as they approach El Paso and Middle Eastern students as they disembark at JFK Airport. At the same time, an elite visa regime has emerged to allow the expedited travel of those with the correct bank balance and commercial interests in the US. Through the contemporary global war on terror and the war on drugs, entrenching inequality between the global South and North, a paranoid, racialized border regime has emerged, sustained by the unfurling of a complex enforcement infrastructure which expands away from the traditional US borderlands into contended colonial and post-colonial territories and nation states under the grip of US imperial control. In this system, a transnational capitalist class are able to freely move with their assets across borders, assisted by the biometric systems and cloud-based paper regimes. All the while, those which the post-colonial scholar Frantz Fanon refers to as the wretched of the earth are tightly monitored by an apparatus which controls their movement through disciplinary mechanisms, which range from border walls to riot police to drone surveillance. This policy of pushing back the border is a nonpartisan one. In 2014, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto implemented Programa Frontera Sur on its southern border due to the Obama administration's concern over the number of children and families arriving at the US border from Central America. Starting in July 2014, Mexico sent 300 border immigration agents to the south, raiding migrant trains and hostels, all with the help of US training and technical assistance. This technical assistance comes from a number of agencies tied to US border enforcement. BORTAC, the tactical special response arm of the US Border Patrol, is one of them, who have been found training former genocide practitioners and CIA assets in Guatemala. BORTAC is not the only agency assisting with enforcement practices in the Global South. The ECBS, the State Department's Export Control and Related Security Program, trains border enforcement agents in East Africa, whilst DHS staff assist in border projects from the Dominican Republic to Poland to Vietnam. One could say that the US empire is in retreat, and in this retreat, it is reinforcing a patchwork of borders across its crumbling imperial possessions to consolidate its hold over markets and economies and streamline labor flows. Through this, the market fundamentalism of neoliberal structural adjustment is granted greater space to wreak havoc, mining both resources and riches of the global South, be it raw materials, minerals, or its people's labor. A critical, subversive voice on the expansion of Washington's border project is the award-winning investigative journalist Todd Miller. Todd has researched and written about border issues for more than 15 years, the last eight as an independent journalist. He is the author of three books: Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security, and the forthcoming, or recently published, I should say, Empire of Borders, the Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World. So, Todd, thank you for joining me. It's been a long road since I called you on the phone at the start of the year about trying to break into a border security conference. Thanks for joining me here on the Just Deportees.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So, I was just mentioning your bio. Your work on the border kind of has been throughout the existence of DHS, so you've seen it sort of emerge and grow and expand. And I'm wondering, what you've seen over the last 15 years, like how the department has grown, how it has managed to justify the growth in its budget. I mean, the billions of dollars that it now manages to get from Congress, but also like its policies and its operations at the border.
Yeah, I remember I was hired on this in a binational organization that worked on border issues in May of 2001. So that's approximately 3 months before 9/11.
Mm.
I ended up working there from about 2001 to 2004, end of 2004, almost 2005. And during my time there, it was a binational organization, so I would cross the border, crisscross. And, we looked particularly at border issues. And really, I got a firsthand glance at what happened, how it was pre-9/11 and to the post-9/11 transition through the implementation of Department of Homeland Security, the implementation of Customs and Border Protection, and then the influx of budgets that were going to that. But also, I was seeing the aftermath of the 1990s operations, which were Operation Hold the Line in El Paso, Operation Gatekeeper in San Diego.
Prevention through deterrence, right.
And the prevention through deterrence strategy was all about, as you know, building up those, urban centers, those border cities, putting, reinforcing, the border line with walls, with more agents, with more technologies. So if you look in the 1990s, you see like the first kind of border surge. If you look at, at the beginning of the 1990s, there's a $1.2 billion border immigration enforcement budget. By the end of the Clinton administration, I believe it was about $4.2 billion. So at the time, we'd never seen such growth.
Yeah.
And it was about that time when I, started really looking into it myself. And right before 9/11, and 9/11, seeing what happened there was, already the prevention through deterrence strategy, which is still the strategy today.
Yeah.
So that's already being, humming along, right? And so at that particular time, when you looked at the initial strategy, the memorandum from the Border Patrol in 1994 was, could be a mortal threat, right? And I was in Southern Arizona. That's where I live, in Southern Arizona. And it was around that time in 2000, 2001, 2002 that we started hearing really horrific stories of people, dying in the desert. So there's that, and then 9/11, and then Department of Homeland Security, and then the priority mission of Customs and Border Protection.
Yep.
Form becomes counterterror and quote-unquote stopping weapons of mass destruction from crossing the border.
Now, while CBP was also tasked with monitoring the... Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Initially, but then it just... There's no plutonium coming over the border.
No, there isn't, but it's still, if you go to cbp.gov, you'll see that that's the priority mission.
Mm.
And though, like you said, nothing's coming over the border, like in that sense, the budgets, just having that as a priority mission was like opening the faucets of these like money and, you know, flows of money that billions and billions and billions of dollars that went into Customs and Border Protection and ICE and all these newly formed counter-terror,
yeah, you know,
prioritizing organized agencies. And so if you go to 1994, when those first operations, the Border and Immigration Enforcement budget was $1.5 billion. If you go to now, or 2018, and you combine CBP and ICE, it's $23 billion. So unbelievable amounts of money have been put in. And that $23 billion is the annual budget, right? So it keeps going up and up and up and up and up and up year after year after year after year.
And congressionally mandated bed spaces for detained migrants. And are there any other congressionally mandated things that this border security nexus has to do? Like, do they...
For example, there's congressionally mandated a budget for 21,000 Border Patrol agents. Right now, they're at around 20,000.
Mm.
It should be at 21,000. So every time I'm able to talk with Border Patrol agents, are talking about, oh, we're pushing towards getting to 21,000. So there's that. It's very similar with a bed mandate.
Mm.
Budget
is, yeah,
for, you know, a certain thousands. What is it now? I think it's 40,000.
Yeah, yeah.
40,000 beds per day, and then they're expected to fill those. So they're paying for that, and the border, they're paying for 21,000 Border Patrol agents, but it's a little bit lower. So that you could look at that as a mandate as well.
So at the start of the sort of lifespan, the current lifespan of the Department of Homeland Security, was there always this ambition to extend border enforcement practice out of the U.S. down, you know, particularly down through Mexico and into Central America? But also your book talks about the Philippines and the Middle East and East Africa. Was there always this project to do that, or is that sort of a byproduct of something else that we'll talk about later in terms of imperialism and sort of something a little bit more macro forces? Or is it an actual policy that you can trace?
There was a very significant shift. And before 9/11, before DHS, there were the INS, Immigration.
Yeah.
They were doing some push out the border operations. I say operations because it wasn't really sustained. So they would, for example, INS would train Mexican agents.
Mm.
In the 1980s, there's evidence that United States paid Mexico to stop people who are fleeing armed conflicts and repression, military repression from Central America. But that was never sustained to the degree. And then what happened with DHS, it just became, there's a whole international affairs department in DHS, or agency in DHS, and this, and you can see almost immediately with the creation of DHS, the kind of language shifting, like Robert Bonner, who was the CBP commissioner,
yeah,
in 2003, he talks about it almost immediately. We're pushing out, they use the word terms like pushing out our borders. We're trying to stop people long before they arrive to our shores or to our border, you know, that sort of language you start seeing. And then I believe in the Homeland Security Act itself, which I can't remember, is it 2003 or?
Yeah, it's 2002, I think.
2002,
yeah.
There's discussion of that, you know, this kind of cooperation. It's in the words, you know, in the terms like cooperation with other countries, partnering with other countries in this kind of building of a border immigration apparatus. And then you see like Michael Chertoff, who's the second DHS secretary, really, really laying it out, detailing it more, like in 2005 and 2006, just saying, we are, you know, pushing on our borders, we're making sure they go far away, and again, with the same idea of, you know, we're not going to allow, you know, we're going to stop people and goods. He's one of the first ones to really stress, you know, the Container Security Initiative, which is basically the pushing out of the border so it examines all packages coming United States from far away. And I think one of the best quotes too was John Kelly during his confirmation.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, summarized it or distilled it by saying the border, we don't want to consider the border being the goal line stand on the 1-foot line that he said, I consider our border to be 1,500 miles to the south in Peru. And Cali, when he said that, was basically, you know, it was quoted when he said it during the confirmation hearing, but that he was really just summarizing what the policy has been for the, you know, over, since DHS, and just kind of underscoring it. But I think that kind of, you know, underscores also the official perspective of how important and how much of a strategic shift it was. And one more thing, when I interviewed CBP officials in Washington, in the international affairs part of the department, I guess, they just stress how much this changed after 9/11. And when I asked one of the officials to explain if he could use one word to describe how much it's grown since 9/11, he said exponentially.
Yeah. This one thing I feel is often missing around the analysis of border enforcement, and at least a lot of journalistic accounts and many like academic accounts as well. I think your book is just so brilliantly brings together a lot of theoretical analysis, which is often missing in journalistic accounts, and succinctly sort of breaks it down for non-academic. I think that's like a real strength of it, actually. But one thing I think is often missing is looking at border enforcement mechanisms as a way to sort of almost discipline what eventually becomes the reserve army of labor, you know, what Marx here, right, the reserve army of labor in the United States. For your work over the last 15 years, but also with, you know, the last three books that you published, how do you see sort of labor flows and this sort of rump undocumented working class? How do you see their position within this whole border enforcement regime that has been emerging since 9/11?
Yeah, I think it's all one way. It's just completely about that, right? It's even without the enforcement regime, if you have these lines of division, and many would say artificially imposed lines of division, and if you go like where I live, southern Arizona, and northern Mexico, right, and you have this line of division that makes absolutely no sense. If you think about it from another perspective, you don't think about it from a nation state perspective.
No, yeah.
It goes right through cities that are, there's ties to these cities. It goes through these places with infrastructure, like sewage systems are connected. It makes absolutely no sense. There's no like river in where I live in Arizona. It's a line in the sand. And, but this artificial line, even if there wasn't a big wall on it, and even if there wasn't all this border patrol and there wasn't all these technologies, it still signifies that on this side of the line, minimum wage is one thing, and then on that side of the line, it's another, right? So you can see like in the U.S.-Mexico border, especially the Maquila program, right? It started in 1965. I think it's 1965 or 1966, in the mid 60s, and then but you see a really like influx of these factories in the post NAFTA era.
Yeah.
And that coincides with the Clinton administration, like Gatekeeper, Safeguard, Hold the Line operation. So you simultaneously have tons of people coming north and getting jobs in these pretty awfully paying jobs in these factories, and then also hitting this reinforced border where it's now, if you want to cross, you have to like circumvent it. And so you have this like almost, you know, wage stratification scheme that's happening right before our eyes, because people just get, it's like, you know, people just get caught in the border, and that creates this pool of labor.
The maquilas are, for the listener there, concentrated around the border areas of the United States.
Yeah. I mean, they're increasingly everywhere in Mexico, but
there's tons of them. Yeah.
Like in Nogales, there's 100.
No, okay. Yeah, and one thing your book captures is the fact that a lot of the security hardware and works that, you know, are used at the border, many of them are actually manufactured in these industrial zones, right?
Right.
So you get this migrant who might have to leave his job in this industrial zone because the pay isn't enough, or he gets laid off. one week he's building. I mean, what, for example, has been made there? That he might encounter on the border later.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to, say, Nogales again, you could be making suitcases, you could be making, like, your, you know, what are they called, Q-tips.
You
could be making a number of things, but it's quite likely, there's a lot of maquilas or factories that do electronic components. And some of them working for different, like, aviation, military, and security companies. And so there's a chance that, you know, a person will be making $7 a day or $8 a day, maybe between $7 and $8 a day, which is not a living wage, making the components of the very surveillance system that might be deployed on the very border that the person might need to cross because they were getting such awful wages. And so that sets up, you know, the labor force that's doing the kind of blue collar, you know, the making of the apparatus. And then what they do is then put it together. There's stipulations, so like somebody in another country can't put a surveillance system together, the whole thing. But then the parts of it, the components of it, get shipped back to the United States and they put it together, maybe in a surveillance tower, maybe in a motion sensor, maybe in a drone even. There's like all kinds of like big defense companies that are, you know, getting their components from these maquilas too. So
this weird sort of boomerang effect, which I think you referred to, right? Do you think that how many of these, so sort of honing in on the security infrastructure at the border, before going back to talk about sort of the way in which this is pushed out to American imperial possessions, as I call them, it might be a bit incendiary, but how have they developed since the beginning of sort of the war on terror? Like, how have these developed, like the ability to sort of, the facial recognition software, the drones, the sophistication of the technology, but also in hand with sort of the militarization of the mentality of Border Patrol.
Yeah, I think that's something that everyone should really be taking a look at, that those sorts of technologies, the surveillance technologies particularly, often surveillance technologies that have been developed in different military operations and war zones by companies who have sold their products to the military are then given another application. They call it like a homeland security application.
Yeah.
And then redeveloped for a border scenario. And it's just a day. I mean, day by day by day, you probably could look at how is the facial recognition technology yesterday, and it's probably already today there's another new thing that they're doing. And facial recognition is part of a biometrics. And biometrics, if you look at the markets around border security or homeland security, they're all growing, right? And some market forecasts call it in a boom period. I've seen that term used. And biometrics, which is facial recognition, iris recognition, even like digital fingerprinting and all, you know, that sort of thing, and those accompanying databases, that sub-market in a border security market is growing. It's one of the biggest growing parts of it. That and the drone technology and robotic technology, like at some of the expos I've gone to, or all of them, I think, you see a lot of robots and different types of robots, which drones, of course, are robots, but there's also miniature drones. And one, I remember, there were, like, these spherical kind of rolling ball robots that NASA was developing for like space travel, but they were trying to reapply that for the space exploration and homeland security exploration. So the vendor was trying to sell these spherical robot as border patrol agents. Like, so the idea that there would be a robotic border patrol with these camera systems, and that they would be able to roll and pack, they said in packs of 20.
Sounds like that thing from Star Wars.
It sounds like
Yeah.
So it's like this kind of science fiction inspired in a way.
Yeah.
You know, you go to those expos and you go into like the vendor where the expo halls where the vendors are selling their technologies, and it does seem like you're in a crystal or like a crystal ball. You're looking at a crystal ball in a science, in a weird dystopian science fiction of what's being developed for the future.
And a lot of I went to one of these which you helped me get into out in San Antonio, probably one of the biggest ones I believe in the country. What I was really struck by, I was expecting, you know, Elbit Systems, Israeli arms company and security tech company, which we'll get to in a moment. I was expecting them, Lockheed Martin. I was expecting all the big dogs, BA Systems, to be there. What I was really surprised were the number of sort of Williamsburg, Brooklyn-looking yuppies in fitted jeans selling drones as well, you know, these middlemen. And when I spoke to them, they said, yeah, Lockheed Martin wants the $1 billion, you know, the multi-million dollar deals to send these fleets of Reaper drones to countries, right? But we provide these types of drones and this equipment to local PDs, local police departments, particularly on the border, which have been deputized to enforce the border. I feel that that's really scary. And they've been approached by people to weaponize them as well.
Yeah. Well, there was there's a document that I think on Freedom of Information request organization was able to get a document from CBP saying that they wanted to weaponize the drones, but they used with non-lethal.
Okay.
Like rubber bullets. I guess. Yeah. Rubber bullets.
Okay.
Which is quite remarkable because if you think about it, right now the Predator B drones, which they're using to surveil the border right now, they fly at around 30,000 feet. So, like, I can't, you know, I'm like, why, you know, how could you categorize it as non-lethal?
If it's fine, it has to fire at a particular velocity from that distance. Yeah.
So I don't know. That was just one bit of evidence, and that was a few years ago. I bet there's more to that. There's probably a push to have some sort of weaponization on the CBP drones, I would imagine.
Yeah. Interesting. But the sort of the thrust of the book is also moves away from the US-Mexico border and, you know, the way the border itself, as mentioned in the introduction, manifests throughout what is essentially the American empire as it's sort of in retreat. One thing which was really striking to me was the number of assets that the United States cultivated during the Cold War, which they are now cashing in on again to assist on border enforcement. In one section, you talk about the Kabils, I guess you could call them the death squads of Guatemala, yeah. Who assist with BORTAC, which is the border patrol's sort of tactical response unit, and of course is Israel as well. In Israel, can you talk a little bit more about sort of these the United States being able to take advantage of those assets that they had cultivated during a conflict long ago, now for a new conflict?
Yeah, like the Kabyle example is a really good one. The Kabyles were, you know, in Guatemala. They were trained by the U.S. Green Berets in the 1960s. And right after, so when you think about Guatemala and Guatemalan history, 1954 was a CIA-instigated coup, which then, after that, there resulted in a 36-year armed conflict with a lot of military repression. Some of the worst of it came from the Special Forces Unit, trained by the U.S. Green Berets, the Kabyles, who were then, by the U.N. Truth Commission report that came out, I believe it was 1999, after the peace accords were signed in 1996, they called the Kabyles a killing machine. So a killing machine that was involved with, I think there was more than 200 massacres that happened. Particularly of indigenous people in Guatemala, 200,000 people nearly were killed, and then to see the same unit, when I went inter the command. So when you look at the new border patrol that Guatemala is forming, the one I went and saw, there's several. There's three of them. One of them is called the Chorti, and that's on the Honduran Guatemalan borderlands, and the commanding structure, so it's the idea of it is you bring the police and the military together. So you have a police commander and a military commander, and the commander, the military commander, is a Kaibil. So it's like this is a counterinsurgency force, which has had horrific human rights violations attached to it, and now all of a sudden, it's in this 21st century era, it is given a homeland. It's like a technology that goes from the military operation to a homeland security operation. You just shift the application, and I really couldn't believe my eyes the first time I saw the Kaibil beret, which is a maroon beret, very infamous in Guatemala, upon the head of the person I was interviewing, and then the next person, the next commander had the same. So it's very
interesting. Yeah.
The Kaibil is very much a part of it. The counterinsurgency of the Cold War has now transformed into the homeland security apparatus. So it's almost like it's very different, but it's so much the same.
Yeah. And yeah, the sort of, I mean, the U.S. is most consistent. Well, I don't even want to say if it's an ally, because it often acts against U.S. interests. But, you know, a partner, a regional partner, which Israel rarely sort of criticizes, if ever, is Israel. And this, the Israel in terms of its occupation of Palestinian land, but also of Syrian land, and its ability to build these very ominous walls throughout the West Bank and occupied territories, has meant that its security industry is world renowned, and it has in the Silicon Wadi, right? They call it the Silicon Wadi, which is the tech area on the coastal plain, has meant, and also the cybersecurity industry in Be'er Seba, I believe, means that Israel is really a world beater in border enforcement, but also cybersecurity enforcement and surveillance. Talk a little bit more about Israel's contribution to U.S. border enforcement, but also the U.S. border enforcement's contribution to Israel as well, and this sort of relationship as it exists.
Yeah, there's definitely a partnership for sure between Israel and the United States. One of the probably the sharpest example of this partnership is well, you could look at Elbit Systems, the company, which is one of the bigger companies in Israel, Haifa-based company, who has been, Elbit was, you know, they've manufactured different, weapon systems and that have been used in Palestinian occupied territories. But they were, when Israel started building the wall, the separation wall in the West Bank, Elbit was tasked as one of the primary technology integrators and helped them develop the smart, quote unquote, what they call smart walls. Walls with all kinds of sensor systems on it, walls that have cameras, the whole idea of a command and control centers, where the cameras and the sensors would feed into these command and control centers that are actually kind of far away. But this like kind of technological eye, or this virtual wall, as they call it, and Elbit then so when the United States there's a long story behind this, but they in 2012 the CBP put out a request for proposals for a sort of surveillance tower that had, you know, all these abilities, the integrated fixed tower, so a virtual wall sort of thing where towers would be working with each other and would be a quote-unquote force multiplier for agents. And when you look at, you know, the different companies that were vying for that contract, Elbit very much used I think 10+ years, I have to paraphrase, but 10+ years securing the world's most challenging border. And then, oh, lo and behold, it's been about 10 years since they've been the primary technology integrator on the in the West Bank wall. And they've done stuff on the Gaza annexation wall as well. So you have this is like a microcosm of the macrocosm of the relationship. You have Israel developing these tech surveillance technologies and whole systems, actually, in Palestinian territories, occupied territories, and then but also simultaneously showing them, showcasing them, say, look how great these are working. And then, of course, Elbit then got the contract with the United States and in 2014 to build 53 integrated fixed towers in southern Arizona, which they have done. Pretty much the last bit, the Tana Atum nation, the reservation.
And indigenous,
the
yeah.
Indigenous size of the state. It's a space the size of the state of Connecticut that borders Mexico. Actually, the aboriginal land of the Atum goes deep into Mexico, but the border just
slices through it, yeah.
Yeah. The last 10 Elbit towers are now going up on the Atum nation, which there was some resistance there about. It's interesting, too, because the Atum nation is a place where people talk about it being occupied. There's so many border patrol already on the Atum nation that you go to the south towards the border, and there's more green-striped vehicles than anything else. So it's you already have people talking about it being a police state or an occupied land, and then you have, you know, these Elbit, you know, these towers that were first put in, like, around West Bank communities are now, you know, being installed on southern Arizona lands, including Native American territories.
Yeah, it makes almost, when you really sort of, like, step back in the way that you have there, it's two indigenous, supposedly sovereign territories, or at least there were treaties or, like, guarantees to give a limited amount of autonomy to the Palestinian Authority or whatever. It's just a violation of these treaties and the maintenance of a settler colonial territorial project over the top of it. To go in a minute. I want to talk, before we sort of wrap up this discussion, about the potential for resistance against such a Leviathan and Labyrinthine type system that exists, you know, these locks and wares across the world that Washington have laid down, and where you've seen resistance manifest itself, and where you think it will be most productive in its capacity to actually enact change and roll back some of the more dehumanizing aspects of this, or maybe even the whole thing.
Well, I mean, one place, when I'm thinking of Palestine, one of the first things I think of is there's an artist named Khaled Jarrar who one of his artworks was taking a sledgehammer to the concrete wall in Jerusalem and just smashing it. And then his whole thing was that he would collect the cement chunks, then melt them down and turn them into something else. The whole idea of this wall is a violation, is a crime against humanity. And now I'm gonna take it down and I'm gonna turn it into something else, use the same material. And in his case, he made sculptures like of a soccer ball for, you know, because he'd met some kids where the wall just went right through their soccer field. I think about Khaled Jarrar because as an artist, I mean, he's done a number of other things that's all about resisting this border, not only in Palestine, but also around the world. He did a similar thing on the U.S.-Mexico border where he took a part of the border wall and turned it into a ladder, you know. And well, you know, this, when you think about this border apparatus, in a lot of ways, like, there's the, you know, and when the Berlin Wall fell, there was 15 border walls in 1989, and now there's almost 77, two-thirds built after 9/11. So this global border apparatus has been coming fast, right? It's really quite, like, when you think about it in its totality, 77 border walls, countless billions of dollars of technologies deployed along those border walls or in border zones, and then probably hundreds of thousands of armed agents that are just deployed. It's like quite overwhelming, and it's so big, and it seems like right now you're seeing like people like in the United States right now.
Well, Trump wants to put a moat and alligators in the beside a wall at the Mexico-U.S. border, right?
Yeah, that's what, and shoot people.
Shoot people, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, the Trump administration in the United States, the brutality on the U.S.-Mexico border has been happening for a long time. But it didn't seem like it was noticed in a significant way until Trump.
Right? Mm.
And, of course, like, first of all, Trump was benefiting in this sense from a bipartisan buildup of an apparatus that's been built up for so long.
Mm.
So when he took the office, there's $20 billion border budget with tons of walls already deployed, prevention through deterrence technologies. But then he ratchets it up even more. But one of the silver linings of the Trump administration, the kind of media coverage and the actual cameras being on the brutality, like a lot of the brutality that happens on the borderlands is there's no cameras there, right? It's purposely designed so the people are in hidden areas. But the cameras being there and showing it almost showed like when you know the population sees that before their own eyes, like a mother being pulled away from her children or families being separated before their eyes, that people were not like, you know, there was a sort of critical mass that formed and said, no, this is, we're not gonna, you know, this, you know, even though this has been happening for so long, there was this, you know, kind of collective mass or critical mass that said no. And actually Trump had to come, you know, before the national audience and say, I'm rescinding, you know, this, or I'm rescinding this policy, even though he only kind of rescinded it. But the point I'm making is that a silver lining to this is almost an awareness that this thing exists. And there's been all kinds of resistance over the years, you know, people like stopping, you know, deportations,
yeah.
Blockading like ICE,
abolish ICE movement.
Abolish ICE
you would never movement. Have had that seven yeah. years ago, I don't think. I don't think. And the migrants are the spearhead of this, right? Of this movement. Abolish ICE, but also sort of like coming to the border in a caravan. That's almost like a very public declaration of the uselessness of borders, or like the almost like the fact that they're not defeated by the prospect of maybe meeting one.
That's the caravans are very interesting in that sense. And just the mass amounts of people that there's like a border is just not going to stop us, right?
Yeah.
You know, the kind of numbers that like the different caravans.
Yeah. I think we can leave on that positive note. The border is not going to stop us. Thank you so much for joining me on There Just Deportees, Todd.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was our show. They Are Just Deportees was made possible with the assistance of the Office of the Advancement of Research, John Jay College.
Our music was produced and performed by Star One. My name is Nick Rodrigo.
And my name is Daralisa Avila Chevalier.
We'll see you next time.